from the dark side.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hello everyone, my name is Sheikh Hussein and you are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph's Campus Community Radio. So do have a nice day.
Delight Entertainment and Promotions is thrilled to present an up-close, intimate, and interactive evening of live music and art inside the E-Bar on Saturday, March 3rd from 7 till 9 p.m. Kicking off the evening is a songwriter circle, incorporating reggae, folk and roots, Celtic harp, and rock and blues. Hear the stories and inspirations behind the songs told and performed by the songwriters themselves, featuring Hezron on tour from Jamaica, Lynn Jackson, Ruth Sutherland, Dave Swider, and Mike Ratzak of the Rhythm Riders. There will also be a live painting and auction from local artist Laurie Warfor Nolan, and stick around afterwards because at 10 p.m. there will be a reggae beach party with a live band performance from Hezron and featuring Juno award-winning reggae artist Correction. Positive vibes all night long. Tickets just $12 at the door for either the songwriter circle or beach party, or $20 for both, and part of the proceeds are being generously donated to CFRU. Don't miss out on this event Saturday, March 3rd at the E-Bar, 41 Quebec Street. Unfortunately, not a physically accessible location.
Whether you're a cinema buff or just someone who wants to know more about movies new and old, then Silver Screen Dream Machine is for you. Tune in on Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. for the radio show all about movies and moving media. The show features cinema-related interviews, movie reviews, theater listings, soundtracks, and tons of great music. We're always looking for contributors of all kinds, so stop by or call 519-837-2378 during the show or email silverscreen@cfru.ca. And come and join the Silver Screen Dream Machine team.
Do you have questions about sexual health strategies? Do you want to know your HIV-STI status and get tested? Every Wednesday, HIV-AIDS Resources and Community Health offers free HIV-STI testing that is anonymous and confidential. You don't need an appointment. They screen for HIV, syphilis, and gonorrhea, and depending on the risk factors and results, they can book follow-up appointments for other tests. If your HIV test is negative, you will know within just 20 minutes. If it is positive, they will conduct another test just to be certain. Come check them out at their accessible location at Speedvale in Dawson, or get more info at archguelph.ca/testing.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. So before the break, we had Mark's Man with Dark of the Days, and then, of course, we had Aaron Matta and The Real News talking about Trump's, I say, the U.S. government's nuclear policy, and how, of course, how it's escalated the situation. And this is one of the things that does need to be discussed, because, of course, the mainstream media, the corporate media, focuses on the 20 nuclear weapons the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has constructed for self-defense after having been targeted by a superpower, an aggressive superpower, armed with thousands, literally thousands of nuclear weapons for about 68 years now. And in fact, like on the show I did last year, I talked about the number of times when, of course, the United States has actually threatened North Korea with nuclear annihilation. And it's been many times over the years. It certainly is not a new thing. It's happened again and again. The United States had nuclear weapons stationed on the peninsula itself for the entirety of the Cold War. Even after that, of course, you had nuclear-capable bombers, U.S. nuclear weapons stationed in Japan and on Guam and these areas nearby, all targeted North Korea. So, basically, what the North Koreans did is they developed a small number of nuclear weapons to serve as a deterrent. They make it too costly for the United States to attack them, too costly to engage in regime change. And that's what they have done. And they only did it as a last resort. And needless to say, they have said again and again they are willing to denuclearize, give up those small number of nuclear weapons they possess, so long as they get a security and assurance that they will not be attacked. As long as they have a security guarantee. As long as they have a peace treaty, a non-aggression pact, something like that, as was discussed in the interviews that we just had before on The Real News. This is what they want. They want security. They want to be able to live in peace without a threat of being attacked, being destroyed. You know, they want to survive. And this is the reason why they have nuclear weapons. And needless to say, that's very different than the United States with its thousands of nuclear weapons. It's now upgrading, planning on spending trillions of dollars on that over the next 30 years to upgrade and strengthen their nuclear arsenal. When the United States faces zero existential threat to its survival, none. And yet, it is the only country in the world that actually maintains a first strike policy. Basically, every other country in the world that has nuclear weapons is committed to using them on a defensive basis, only in retaliation. The United States is the only one that actually says it will use nuclear weapons first, offensively. Once again, a very important thing to keep in mind. Now, what I want to play now, where I want to take this forward, to some degree, this is a bit of a recap, but the Empire Files did an excellent episode on, and this, is, I believe, was right after Trump made his famous fire and fury comments threatening war with North Korea. The Empire Files with Abby Martin on Telesur did an excellent episode where they cut through the propaganda. In fact, the entire episode is called War with North Korea, Propaganda versus Reality. They debunked a lot of the myths and really put the whole thing in perspective. That once again, we have an imperial power that with thousands of nuclear weapons, trying to bully, trying to destroy, trying to isolate, trying to overthrow a single socialist government in a small, tiny country. And once again, how many times have we seen this since the end of World War II? We've seen it again and again. And just in the case of North Korea, they have the capacity to hit it back. They have a small number of nuclear weapons. They can defend themselves. And that's the main thing that distinguishes themselves from Iraq, from Syria, from Libya, all these other places that have been devastated. By the foreign policy of the United States. So I'm going to play this episode of the Empire Files with Abby Martin right here, talking about the war with North Korea, propaganda versus reality. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Among several growing dangers of new wars under the Trump administration, tensions seem to be intensifying most quickly with the one that's also a nuclear power. Just weeks after the 72nd anniversary of the U.S. nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Trump confronted North Korea with some of the most overtly genocidal threats I've ever heard.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
Trump has doubled down on the ruthlessness of the official White House statement with several unhinged tweets threatening nuclear annihilation. In one, saying his nuclear button is, quote, much bigger and more powerful than Kim Jong-un's. The Trump cabinet has even drafted war plans plotting a first strike against North Korea's nuclear sites. The threats have escalated alongside other modes of attack, including harsh new sanctions on the Korean economy. Despite the immense gravity of a U.S. war drive on the peninsula, Trump has seen little resistance from the self-appointed resistance led by the Democratic Party. But the bipartisan support for attacking a sovereign nation only exists among those privileged elites who will profit from such a war. The people of the United States, despite being bombarded with fear-mongering propaganda, think much differently than the millionaires who supposedly represent them. Throughout Asia and the United States alike, many have been holding protests denouncing the threats. The Empire Files attended one of those actions in Los Angeles.
I'm out here because President Trump's fire and fury statement, and also he stand on the UN podium, says total destruction to the North Korea. So we are denouncing his statement also. Tell him that he's not welcome in Korea.
트럼프가 평화를 위협하고 제3차 세계대전이 일어날 수 있을 수 있는 그런 망언들을 늘어놓기 때문에 한반도에 살고 있는 한 사람으로서 이 자리에 있는 것입니다.
And you know, growing up in the US, I remember kids always asking me, what are you? Where are you from? Right? And this doesn't bother me much because, you know, I'm Korean and I'm proud to be Korean. But then they'd ask me, are you North Korean or South Korean? Then they'd reassure me and say, oh, okay, South Korea is good. South Korea is our friend. North Korea is our enemy. And I'd be thinking, wow, really? Like, we're 8 years old. How do you already have an enemy of an entire nation that you probably can't even find on a map?
They said always North Korea is a provoke to South Korea and the neighboring country, but they always on the defense mode. U.S. is the only country that use the nukes, have about 6,000 of nukes. This is a matter of North Koreans and South Korean people's life and death. Because nuclear war is no winner.
With a U.S. administration that continuously does the unthinkable, I sat down with journalist and expert in U.S.-Korea relations, Tim Sharrock, to learn what's being totally left out of the debate in the U.S. media and in Washington.
Everyone talks about North Korea, of course, as this police state dictatorship, and that's why it's our enemy, right? And South Korea is our ally because it shares our Western values of democracy and freedom. Do you agree with that?
Until, you know, the late 1980s, you know, South Korea was a pretty dark dictatorship, too. And, you know, we supported, the United States supported a succession of police states there. After Syngman Rhee was overthrown, there was about 1 year of a somewhat progressive government in 1960 to 61 that wanted to, you know, start talking about unification. It wasn't that far after this the division and the terrible, you know, impact of the Korean War. But 1961, there's a military coup. Park Chung-hee, former general trained by the Japanese Imperial Forces, he took over as a military dictator in South Korea, and we supported that government until his assassination in 1979 with huge amounts of military aid. Park government supported the U.S., sent troops to Vietnam to back the U.S., you know, war in Vietnam, in southern Vietnam. And so, you know, we had this relationship with a succession of dictatorial governments in the South. And the Park Chung-hee government talking about, you know, I mean, talk about a police state, talk about a surveillance state, talk about a torture state, you know, and yet we poured, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into supporting them and to against the will of the Korean people. And there was another military coup in 1980 that was another general took over after Park was killed. And, you know, he took power by killing hundreds of people in the southwestern city of Gwangju. And, you know, even when there was an uprising against that military coup against martial law forces, the U.S. Worked with the Korean military to put down the uprising. And, you know, this was really shocking to a lot of South Koreans and felt people felt very betrayed. And they finally stood up and won their democracy in the late 1980s, 1987, 1988. So, you know, until then, that whole myth was not applicable, you know. But I think the reason that we're in the United States still has massive amounts of military forces in South Korea is not just North Korea. And most of the U.S. bases in Japan are in Okinawa, and those are seen as forward bases for the U.S. to project power in Asia and throughout the world, really. So you know, the rationale has sort of changed.
I was going to ask, the enemy of the state laws and kind of the repression of political dissidents, are those holdovers from these military dictatorships that you were talking about?
Yeah, they are. South Korea has a law called the National Security Law, under which if you say anything that sounds like it's what North Korea says, you can be jailed. And you can be jailed for having North Korean literature. You can be jailed for traveling there without authority from the South Korean government. And so lots of people have been, you know, persecuted under this national security law. In the past, it was used as a way to just stifle dissent, period. And, you know, lots of people during the Park period, Park Chung-hee, in Chun-doo-on period, were executed under the national security law. There was lots of trumped up charges just on this loose law that said, you know, if you say anything that's close to what North Korea says, you're a communist and you're a pro-North Korean, therefore you're to be prosecuted. I mean, under Park Chung-hee, there was cases of, you know, there'd be a group of people that might have studied Marxism or something, and they would like, you know, all 30 of them, they would charge them all with anti-state, you know, and violations of the national security law.
Horrific.
Many of those people back in the 70s were executed. And, you know, people spent decades in prison under this law. And this law is still in place. And a lot of people in South Korea feel like South Korea can't really be a truly democratic country until it gets rid of this law. And under the national security law, even after you're released from prison, you have to report to the police once or twice a year, and you have to tell them everything that you did that might violate the national security law, and also anyone you know that may have violated the national security law.
North Korea, of course, or the DPRK, is a country that essentially the media can say anything about it, and people believe it because it's so closed off, right? And I've heard stories, everything from mass, cannibalization to Kim Jong-un, who has his forces just execute people who aren't crying hard enough at, like, military parades. I mean, it's comical, the amount of disinfo. Do you care to debunk any common misconceptions about the country?
Well, the most common misperception is that the leadership is crazy and irrational.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing crazy and irrational about trying to, defend your country from what you consider to be, you know, a military force that's out to destroy you. I mean, that's totally rational. And I think, you know, building nuclear weapons, when you look out at the world and you see what happened, say, in Libya to Gaddafi, when he gave up his nuclear program, and then a few years later, U.S. and NATO, you know, displace him in a war, and, you know, put in a government that's completely chaotic now, and he sees this happening when he, you know, to a leader who did give up his weapons. Well, that's even more of a reason. People in North Korea have the same kind of wants and desires that people all over the world do. You know, to live in safety and to have a, you know, good health system and to have, you know, jobs and income and, you know, water and food, everything. You know, the people are no different, North and South Korea. You know, there's no reason to gloss over the nature of the authoritarian state in North Korea, because it's present. We know that there's many political prisoners, but you know, the country has developed over time. It's come back from, you know, it was pretty much destroyed in the Korean War. They have pride in their economic developments. I mean, this is a country that was destroyed at one point. Within 20 years, it had a very flourishing economy. You know, and North Korea had a kind of interesting history as a socialist country, because it had this philosophy of Kim Il-sung's philosophy was, you know, self-reliance, called Juche, and developed their own self-sufficient economy. And so they didn't want to be integrated into the world market So North Korea developed their own, you know, industry, you know, without being dependent on any one country, and they were very proud of it, you know, you can see the fact that, you know, a country that can develop a nuclear weapon and also develop very sophisticated missiles is not a backward country. Mm-hmm. And they maintain a certain degree of independence from all their allies. The other critical thing that Americans really need to know is that that's, you know, yes, it's their country. It was split arbitrarily. It should never have been split. Dean Rusk, you know, who was a low-level State Department guy, walked into a room and looked at a map of Korea and saw the 38th parallel on a map, a National Geographic map, and said, we'll divide it right there. And so it was completely arbitrary, and there was supposed to be, a unified Korea after that, and that was just supposed to be temporary. But, you know, it didn't turn out to be that way.
Let's move on to the Korean War. When I grew up in school, you know, you hear about World War I, World War II, Vietnam, of course, but you don't really learn much about this war. It's called the Hidden War for a reason, but we're nonetheless taught that the U.S. was forced to respond because of this invasion of the South by the North. What really happened?
Well, the origins of the Korean War go back to that division in 1945. Throughout the country, there had been, sort of these people committees were formed throughout the country, North and South, right after the division, because people want to have a unified Korea. In the North, they were recognized as legitimate organizations, these people's committees. In the South, right away, the U.S. sided with people put in power, people who had collaborated with the Japanese colonialists, Korean police who had been trained by and, you know, used by the Japanese colonialists as police. These were the people who were running the government and running the police. And they saw, the U.S. saw these people's committees as communist-inspired and would not allow them to operate. And so he drove a lot of the sort of pro-independence, pro-unification forces, you know, underground. And eventually it became in the South in the late 40s. There was like civil war basically throughout the South, you know, leftist fighting against this right-wing government. And 1947, for example, in the southern island of Jeju, the largest island in Korea, the whole island voted. There was a plebiscite in 1948 where the whole island voted against dividing the country, which the President Syngman Rhee wanted to do. And right away, there was a small revolt against the occupiers of the island, who were these police who had collaborated with the Japanese. And the U.S. immediately saw this as like, you know, some communist-inspired revolt, declared the whole island Red Island, and oversaw a counterinsurgency campaign in which 30 to 40,000 people were killed. So, you know, all this kind of led up to the formation of two different states. First, South Korea declared itself Republic of Korea. And then after that, North Korea formed the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, after there was an official South Korea formed. And there was tensions along the border. And, you know, 1950, June 1950, Kim Il-sung, the leader of North Korea, decided the time was ripe to, in his view, to liberate the whole country from the U.S. And then they made a decision, Truman made a decision, to actually send U.S. forces and South Korean forces north and to occupy the North. To roll back communism, that was the idea then. And the problem with not having a democracy in South Korea is that this story has been covered up, how this came to be, until the late 80s. People couldn't even know their own history. And then, like I was saying before, under this national security law, if you started, you know, retelling the history and it sounded like North Korean history, you could be arrested under the national security law. So it's really difficult to even come to grips with your own history there.
The death and destruction caused by the U.S. Empire in the Korean War, what were the targets, tactics, and how many people were killed?
It's hard to say how many people were killed. I mean, I've heard like, you know, upwards of 3 million civilians were killed. You know, I think 3 to 4 million Koreans were killed. But they bombed everything they could bomb. I mean, they would strafe, you know, railroad, anything moving on the ground, railroads, trucks, anything like that. Everything was open to blow up. and they dropped, you know, millions and millions of barrels of napalm. I mean, they really perfected the use of napalm in Korea, in northern Korea. And so they just, you know, they would just attack towns and villages. You know, everything was considered, you know, enemy territory. So it was up for bombing. And they would just bomb everything they possibly could. And there was, you know, towards the end of the war, the U.S. Air Force actually stopped sending sorties because there was nothing, there was no targets left. I mean, it was really completely flattened. And, you know, the U.S. was actually thinking of they came very close to dropping nuclear weapons on North Korea. And General MacArthur was finally removed from his command, in part because he wanted to nuke 20 Chinese cities, you know.
And people say today the DPRK is obsessed with its military might, right? It keeps building up the military, and it seems like there's a direct correlation to the complete devastation. I mean, 30% of its population.
They remember that. It's part of their national mythology. I mean, you know, we have our Civil War, we have our Revolutionary War, they have the Korean War, and which they considered a war of liberation. And they did, you know, they did, with the help of the Chinese, kick the U.S. out of the North. So, you know, they don't want that to ever happen again. And yeah, that's part of their national psyche.
New reports show the Pentagon is preparing for an all-out war with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. This includes launching major military drills and deploying thousands of additional forces to Guam, Japan, and South Korea, including additional B-52s, the aircraft that drops nuclear weapons. Top U.S. officials have confirmed Trump's belligerent threats, telling the public to be prepared for war.
And if North Korea does not choose the pathway of engagement, discussion, negotiation, then they themselves will trigger an option.
Tonight, a dire warning from Defense Secretary James Mattis that North Korea should cease any consideration of actions that would lead to the end of its regime and the destruction of its people.
What's different about this approach is that we're out of time, right? As Ambassador Haley said before, you know, we've been kicking the can down the road and we're out of road. There is a military option.
While the Trump regime wants to turn up the heat, the threats have actually triggered highly unusual peace talks between North and South, behind the back of the U.S. empire. But could such talks prevent a determined U.S. war machine, especially with new conditions being set by Washington?
Is there any way in which the U.S. can coexist with a nuclear North Korea?
Anthony, I don't think we can tolerate that risk. The world can't tolerate that risk.
The civilized world must remain united and vigilant against the rogue state's development of a nuclear arsenal. We will never accept a nuclear North Korea.
The rest of the world is quite resolute in this stand we're taking that we will never accept them as a nuclear power.
The DPRK already has nuclear weapons. It's clearly unrealistic they would ever give them up. But that's what the U.S. is now saying justifies an attack. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley recently said that North Korea was begging for war. And certainly there has been agreements in the past between even the U.S. and North Korea that has stalled or completely halted for a period of time their nuclear
right.
program. And so let's go back. I mean, the Trump administration is so belligerent, but let's go back to the Clinton administration. There was an agreement that ended up freezing its nuclear program for 12 years.
Right.
So what was that agreement, and then how did Bush muck it up?
Well, late 1980s, you know, North Korea under Kim Il Sung started looking at, you know, having nuclear weapons, and part of the reason was because until 1991, the U.S. had nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons in South Korea, hundreds of them, these kind of handheld weapons that U.S. soldiers would carry. Their nuclear weapons had hundreds of them in South Korea, and of course the U.S. Seventh Fleet is in Yokosuka, Japan, and very close to Korea, and there's ships there that have nuclear arms, planes, and Okinawa, the U.S. bases are there, and so they saw, you know, building a nuclear capability was a way of defending themselves. They had signed the NPT, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, and when they decided to proceed in a nuclear program, they pulled out of the NPT, and to that that pulling out of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty was like a red line for the U.S. And actually, the Clinton administration seriously considered a nuclear strike on the Yongbyon facilities at the time. They came very close to it. And there was a lot of talk of war. It was just like there is, you know, just like today. People might remember, you know, Jimmy Carter went to North Korea, flew to North Korea, met with Kim Il-sung, and they hammered out what became this agreed framework under which North Korea agreed to end its nuclear program, stop its production of plutonium at this plant. And so when Bush took over in 2001, with all these neocons in his government, like John Bolton and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, were against this agreement, any agreement with North Korea. In his State of the Union address, Bush labeled North Korea as part of the Axis of Evil with Iran and Iraq. So this was like the last straw for the North Koreans. They said, okay, we now see that you believe we're back in enemy status. And so they pulled out of the agreement themselves and started proceeding on their plutonium program. And by 2006, they had built their first atomic weapon and tested their first weapon in 2006.
Negotiations, didn't they start later on during the Bush administration? And then it was Obama that actually completely, again, destroyed them.
2005, there was a declaration by all South, North Korea, U.S., Japan, China, and Russia that there no, that Korea itself would be would not be nuclear, would not allow nuclear weapons, North or South. All the countries agreed to that. That agreement with the five countries had been violated by the U.S. because at the time the U.S. was still imposing, you know, sanctions kept being imposed. And when Obama came in 2009, he and his people sort of had this idea that somehow the problem of North Korea would go away because it was going to collapse. And they did not want to negotiate directly with North Korea. So even, you know, Bush was willing to have direct talks with them. Obama was not. Gaddafi was overthrown in Libya, and he had, of course, given up his nuclear weapons. And they figured, well, our nuclear weapons and a powerful military is our only protection against this happening to us.
But representatives have said that they would never strike first, right? And also that this whole history proves that they're willing to negotiate away their nuclear program under certain conditions. So it just seems to contradict the claim that we hear continuously from the U.S., which is this is all about stopping North Korea from having nukes.
Right. It may be, you know, it may be too late to stop them from having nukes. I mean, you know, they have nukes. I mean, they're nuclear power. Right. You know, they have them, and they have obviously really, you know, well-developed missile program. Look, they see themselves surrounded. You know, and of course, the U.S. has a very powerful military in the South. But I mean, U.S. military is in alliance with the South Korean military, which is a very, very powerful military in itself, and Japan's. Constant war games, constant, you know, ratcheting up the tensions. North Korea, and what's kind of interesting when you look at the so-called threat from each side, like you hear Trump say, you know, fire and fury like the world has never seen before, like, you know, bringing up images of, that's what Truman said before he dropped the bomb on Nagasaki, the second bomb, right? Similar kinds of words, but it's basically, you know, we're going to inflict a Holocaust on you. And then you look at their threats. All America was all shocked when they said they might test some missiles by firing them towards Guam. You know, why Guam? Well, that's where these B-1 bombers are based, where these B-1 bombers fly regular missions from there over Korean skies. They have massive amounts of firepower on those planes. I mean, they're, you know, bunker buster bombs, all kinds of munitions that could, you know, blow half the cities, you know, of North Korea, you know, sky high. So, you know, the U.S. keeps saying, you know, we're ready to annihilate you, and they say, well, we might fire a missile towards Guam, where this so their threats tend to be more particularized, you know, towards a U.S. base.
And it's all you see all day over the news. What are we going to do? This missile was launched. It's just
and
nuts.
They don't, and like the U.S. media never looks at it from their point of view. What is it like to hear like your country may be annihilated? Annihilation means everybody's dead. There's 25 million people in North Korea. So what, we're going to kill 25 million people to prevent them from having one nuclear weapon without even talking to them?
How does this type of rhetoric resonate with South Koreans and the administration?
Well, it scares the hell out of people in South Korea because people are there. Actually, when I was there in April and May, people there are far more worried about what Trump might do than what Kim Jong-un would do. They're used to these kinds of, you know, tensions with North Korea. South Koreans, you know, when they hear Trump talking about fire and fury, I guess Trump doesn't realize that thousands and thousands of South Koreans have relatives in North Korea. Their families are. He's talking about their families, maybe their grandfather, their great grandfather, their brother. You know, so when he's talking about destroying the entire North Korean people, he's talking about destroying their own relative, and they see it as one country, and they don't see it in this divisive way that so many of our leaders do here. And I might add, in both parties, Democrat, Republican, they're the same. You hear the same hawkish stuff from both sides.
And the complete dehumanization of North Koreans as if they're all just robots who hypnotically following and worshiping their dear leader. They're human beings.
They're human beings. Because instead of seeing them as just these demonic, you know, crazy people, we should see them as human beings with hopes and dreams for their country like anybody else, and try to reach some common ground with them.
You know, many in the U.S. establishment are arguing for a major war, as we're talking about, which would no doubt trigger just a death and destruction, you know, on a horrific scale. What would that look like for Korea, U.S. soldiers, and if regime change was successfully led by the U.S., what do you think would replace the regime?
You know, so the U.S., you read like the CNN story the other day from Barbara Starr, it was just a shelf for the Pentagon. She talks about a one-month war. You know, they go in there and somehow take out their missile sites and take out nuclear sites. You know, obviously that in itself would kill tens of thousands of people. But, you know, North Korea, if they're attacked, they're going to fire back. You know, they're not going to take this lying down. So, you know, an attack on Korea could generate not only counterattack on South Korea, but a counterattack on Japan. I mean, it would be a regional war, you know, but there's a lot of people in the U.S. military that know how destructive a war would be in Korea. Anyone who's served there, mountainous country, and you know, the people, they know the North Korean army, you know, would put up a hell of a fight. And they know that the cost would be millions of lives. And I think that's the one factor that's maybe holding back U.S., you know, Trump and his people. But now they're talking, you know, they keep talking about the military option. War is, to me, it's just obscene to be talking about war as an option when it could kill, you know, millions of people. I guess, you know, Senator Lindsey Graham just says that's people over there, it's not going to bother, you know. It's only those Asian people are going to get killed. Even Japan, you know, but so what? We're not there. But I mean, you know, tens of thousands of Americans could get killed too. And as far as your second question, I mean, what I know from when I've been following these sort of regime changes here, these people, the Rand Corporation, for example, Bruce Bennett, who's a specialist at the Rand Corporation, who thinks that, you know, the target should be Kim Jong-un.
Worked closely on the interview with Seth Rogen.
Exactly. And helped that movie, you know, helped with the end of the movie where they blew his head apart. Mm. And said that was a good idea to keep that in. Well, their model is to have the sort of U.S.-induced, you know, regime change from within, like they're going to somehow win over all these North Korean elites, you know, to somehow go along with some kind of U.S. plan, to have a U.S.-backed government in North Korea, overthrow their government. And when you read carefully what they have to say and hear what they have to say, it's like South Korea isn't even part of their discussion. And there was a sort of rumor that got into a story. Some reporter picked up some intelligence from some counterinsurgency people in Washington who are, you know, consultants and contractors. And they were saying, oh, well, we're talking to the Trump administration about, you know, doing a counterinsurgency in North Korea. I mean, these people are nuts. They don't know anything about Korea. I mean, the idea that somehow the U.S. is going to go in there and direct this regime change in North Korea, and everything's going to be, you know, we're going to have a pro-U.S. government there, and everything's going to be fine, is the same kind of mentality as the United States had. It's in 1945, which is, we know what's best for Korea, and we're going to determine it, and we don't give a damn what you Koreans think. It's exactly the same mentality. And you know, somehow, you know, we in America have to learn the real history.
Okay, so we have Brendan Campisi here again to talk about the politics of war and the limits of power by Kalko. So another topic he talks about is the transition in Korea. So what does he say about that?
All right. So the very first mention of Korea in the politics of war, and the first point when Korea sort of gained any kind of attention in terms of global politics during this period, was in 1943, when at a conference of the great powers in Moscow, a very sort of vague and more or less perfunctory agreement was reached to take Korea into some kind of trusteeship after the war, after the Japanese had been defeated, and that it would be essentially run by one or all of the great powers. And the United States wanted that to last for as long as possible. They suggested 20 or 30 years. The Soviets didn't want to make any kind of firm commitment in terms of years, but what they were arguing was that it should be as brief as possible. The Soviets weren't pushing for, in terms of what was going to happen to former Axis colonies and even other European colonies, the Soviets at this point weren't pushing for immediate independence anywhere, mostly because they knew that the Western Allied countries were just not going to get behind that, so there was no possible agreement that could be made on that basis. But they were always advocating for as limited a period of sort of foreign rule as they could get the Americans and the British to agree to, basically. So the situation in Korea, of course, was that it was occupied by the Japanese, and it had been since 1910. And it had been subjected to very, very brutal colonial rule. The vast majority of Koreans under Japanese rule were kept in low-paying, dangerous industrial work or were peasants. And many of the Korean landlord class were dispossessed, and the land was taken over by Japanese landowners. And there was a great deal of industrial development in Japanese-ruled Korea, but it was all to export to Japan. It was all determined by the economic priorities of Japan. And Koreans were subjected to a great deal of national oppression as well. They were forbidden from writing or publishing in their own language. They had to take Japanese names, and they were basically taught in the educational system that Korean culture was inferior, and that you know, Japan was superior. So the situation of Koreans under the Japanese occupation was one of brutal economic exploitation and national oppression. So there was a very developed resistance movement in Japanese-occupied Korea. There were a number of sort of political tendencies in it, but mostly it was basically leftist. The Korean Communist Party had a very small presence on the ground in Korea, but they were an important force in the resistance nonetheless. And then there were also various Korean resistance groups in exile. There was a group led by Kim Il-sung that during the war was in the Soviet Union, but in the 1930s had been in Northern China fighting the Japanese alongside the communists. There was another group of Korean communists in southern China that was also fighting alongside Mao, fighting the Japanese. And then there were right-wing nationalist exiles in Western countries, mostly in the United States, and their main leader was Syngman Rhee. And of course, Rhee and Kim Il-sung eventually become the leading figures of post-war Korea in their respective Korean states. So in the war in Korea ends, or the Japanese occupation in Korea, I should say, ends in August 1945, when the Soviets defeat the Japanese. And at this point, the Korean people basically rise up. And Kalko describes Korea at this point as a very intensely politicized society. The resistance to Japan, again, had been a mass phenomenon, and there was this deep and broad underground organization among the Korean people. And as soon as the Japanese were gone, that became the government. Popular committees were organized in every city and town in Korea, and they started running the place, basically, everywhere where the Japanese military forces weren't still present. And they elected a national leader, or they elected sort of regional leaderships and national leaderships. And by late summer in 1945, they'd proclaimed the People's Republic of Korea. And there was a very clear political program that these popular committees were pushing for and that the Korean masses were demanding, and that involved nationalizing all foreign-owned industry, which was basically industry in Korea, and land reform, and independence, finally, independence for the country. So there was a very clear social and national program that the Korean people were demanding. And at this point, the Americans enter southern Korea, because the Soviets had agreed during the war that even if they were the ones who actually militarily liberated all of Korea, there would be two occupation zones, one in the north that they would control, and then an American occupation zone in the south. And, you know, it might seem strange that the Soviets would agree to this when there were no Americans, at a point when there were no American soldiers on the ground in Korea, but you have to remember that they were mostly concerned with sort of with the international diplomatic level of their relations with the United States, not, you know, the situation on the ground in one tiny country that was, you know, strategically not very significant for anybody at this point, wasn't, you know, a primary consideration. So they made that agreement, and the Americans started taking over their occupation zone in the south. But the thing is, before the Americans had any troops on the ground in Korea, they tried to exert their control through the Japanese military that were still there. They were giving orders to the Japanese in Korea, and they were giving them orders to suppress demonstrations and not to allow this sort of this energy and this politicization of the Korean people to release itself in any kind of substantial way. There was an order given that when the Americans showed up, when the American troops arrived in Korea, there were to be no demonstrations even to welcome them. But there was. Not so much because people were happy to see the Americans, but because they were happy that their country was liberated from the Japanese. But there was this huge popular demonstration to welcome the American troops when they arrived. And the Americans ordered Japanese soldiers to fire on that demonstration, and a few people were killed. That, to me, I think, is a really sort of evocative moment of the post-war situation in Korea and the post-war situation in Asia. Because effectively, the Americans were willing to use, and the British and the French in their colonial possessions were willing to use the existing Japanese military forces that they'd just been fighting to crush nationalist movements and movements of the left. So that's the very, very beginning of the American occupation in South Korea. In North Korea, the Soviets found that the people had taken over, you know, the people had taken over the towns. They were running the towns and the cities, and they were running the factories, and, you know, basically a popular self-government existed already, and they simply decided to recognize it. And they handed over as much political power as they could to the popular committees, even while they were still militarily in control of the northern area of the country. So it's at this point, August and September 1945, that the fortunes of North and South Korea start to diverge. Because in the North, what happened was that this program that the Korean people were overwhelmingly and very clearly demanding started to be carried out. There was nationalization of all the existing industry, and Northern Korea actually had most of the industrial infrastructure of Korea under the Japanese, where South Korea had the majority, or Southern Korea, I suppose, had the majority of the population and of the agricultural productivity. So that industrial base was taken into social ownership, and there was a huge, huge program of land redistribution. The landlords in Northern Korea were given the option of staying as smallholding farmers, just like their former tenants, or of leaving. And the overwhelming majority of them went to South Korea. They simply, they couldn't conceive of being anything other than the ruling class. So essentially, in Northern Korea, 1945, a revolution is carried out by a popular and democratic government. That's the birth of North Korea, basically. And in South Korea, meanwhile, the situation is very, very different. Because while the masses in Southern Korea are pushing for this exact same program of demands of nationalization, of land reform, of democracy and independence for Korea, the American military government is in no way inclined to meet that program. Kalko makes the point that even compared to some of the other American occupation administrations in places like Germany or Japan, the Korean one was staffed overwhelmingly by extremely conservative military men, men with no democratic sensibility whatsoever, basically authoritarian sensibilities. And importantly, many of the American military leaders in Korea at this point saw war with the Soviet Union as imminent and felt that they were, logically, if that was going to happen, they were going to be on the front lines of the very, very shortly to arrive war with the Soviet Union. So there was the political character of the American military government in South Korea was bitterly anti-communist and very conservative. And that sort of prejudged what sort of political forces they were going to be working with in Korea. The Americans had a bit of a problem in Korea, which is that most of the conservative forces that they would be willing to work with had actually collaborated with the Japanese. And so it would, you know, it would look bad. It would be bad public relations, if nothing else, if suddenly the new government that they were sponsoring was full of Japanese collaborators. Thankfully, there were nationalist forces on the right, forces that had not collaborated with the Japanese, again, led by Syngman Rhee. So they very quickly created a very, very prominent role for Rhee and for his followers. But at the level of local governments and the police and the military that they started to create, it was full of Japanese collaborators. When they arrived, they'd found in some areas of Southern Korea where the Japanese weren't still in control, a very similar situation to the ones the Soviets found, where the workers and peasants were simply running the towns and the villages, and land was being redistributed in a very orderly way, actually, and the industrial infrastructure was being run by the workers. And of course, in very sharp contrast to what the Soviets did, they made sure that all that property was taken back. If it was Japanese, they couldn't exactly give it back to its proper, or what they viewed as its proper owners, but if it was Korean, then they definitely tried to. And they actually took legal possession of a huge amount of land that had already been redistributed, and they took the land that had been under Japanese ownership, and they sold it, they just sold it on the open market with no kind of control whatsoever. So, as Kalko describes, most of it ends up in the hands of the existing landowning class or black marketeers and people who'd been able to get rich during the war off of the black market. There was also an enormous black market in Southern Korea at this time that American soldiers were participating in, and that was, again, similarly to China, causing massive inflation and pushing people into poverty. And the American military government imposed wage controls, but not any kind of price controls. So the consequence of that was just to push the workers and peasants in Southern Korea just deeper and deeper into poverty. And as a consequence, soon you have strikes and protests going on all over Southern Korea at a very, very high level. Hundreds of thousands of people are going on strike and protesting. There was an incident where a railroad strike turned into a general strike, which was then repressed by the Americans at the cost of dozens of strikers being shot dead. And then that led to mass protests from other areas of the workforce and from students that they had to suppress. The Americans and the Korean police that they were creating had to suppress with enormous brutality. And very quickly, the American military government in South Korea came to regard any expression of dissent as simply communist and Russian backed, and just not to be dealt with in any other way but repression and force. And in that context, they had elections in Southern Korea in the summer of 1946. And so these elections were an obvious obvious fraud, basically. What they did was they held the elections in a number of levels so that, as one official who actually participated in this described, so that undesirables could be weeded out. And they limited the vote to household heads or the heads of 10 households. So essentially they were limiting the vote to men with some kind of position of authority in their communities. And at this point, much of the left in Southern Korea, which had a mass base and mass support, was already being suppressed. People were already being thrown in prison or hiding in the mountains from right-wing and American repression. So in that context, the election was an obvious victory for the right. And while this is going on, the other powers, the other great powers who wanted to have a say in Korea, they didn't want the Americans to be running the whole show, start complaining about this situation, especially the Soviets, who are concerned with the repression of the left in South Korea and the sort of empowerment of forces that they understand are very, very hostile to communism and to the Soviet Union in South Korea. And the Americans just try to fob them off, basically, and sort of convince them they don't really need to have any kind of say in what goes on in Korea. But they try to come to an agreement with the Soviets about holding elections in both of the zones. But the Soviets insist on excluding political forces that have rejected previous agreements on the subject of Korea made by the United States and the Soviet Union, and on rejecting the inclusion of sort of political forces that are known to be anti-Soviet, which would exclude the forces that the Americans were supporting already. So they couldn't really come to any kind of agreement on elections in both zones. And at this point, the Americans come up with the idea of using the United Nations to, this is in 1946-47 we're talking about now, to legitimize elections that they want to have in the southern zone in Korea anyway. So a UN commission is created to study the possibility of having an election in South Korea, having an election that would, at this point it was clear, lead to the creation of a new state. And on that commission are Canada, Australia, El Salvador, the Republic of China, so the Kuomintang, and the Philippines. So we have neocolonial American puppet states and a couple of Western countries that are very closely aligned to the United States, even if they're, you know, actually independent compared to the Philippines or El Salvador. But even this body very quickly realized that the situation in Korea is not one where any kind of free elections could be held, because when they go to South Korea, they're totally dependent on the military government and on the existing Korean administration that the Americans have set up to get around and to get any kind of information. They discover they aren't able to visit many of the leaders of the left-wing parties to even talk to them, because they're either in prison or in hiding. So this UN commission very quickly realizes that there's no possibility of having a free election in the conditions of repression that exists. It should be mentioned that it wasn't just the American military or the new Korean police that were repressing the left. The Americans had allowed right-wing parties to create militias, basically, including one that was explicitly and consciously modeled in the Hitler Youth. That was, I think, the one tied to Syngman Rhee's party, to terrorize the left. So in conditions of massive right-wing repression, the commission realizes they can't hold free elections. So the Canadian and Australian representatives say that they should just describe the situation as it is and say that they couldn't support holding elections. But the representatives from China and the Philippines and El Salvador, whose governments are, of course, much, much more dependent on the United States, say that they were given a task to legitimize these elections, and that's what they have to do. And eventually there's also a French representative, and eventually the French representative comes around to the position of the puppet states, and so the commission agrees. The Canadians and Australians, reluctantly but ultimately, they do agree to recommend that these elections be held and to stay in Southern Korea and observe the elections